This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
I'd like to invite our first panelists to join me, Dr. Ariel Mays and Professor Stephen Wilf. And it's my pleasure and privilege to open our first panel discussion this morning on privacy and intellectual property. Let me tell you how it's going to work this morning. I'll begin by introducing my fellow panelists and outline what we're going to be doing in this session. And then I'll invite you to consider an ancient text that can help frame some of the dilemmas and challenges that we'll consider today together. And then I'll invite my co-panelists to address you. Let me say at the outset, as one of the chairs of the program, that we are hoping for lively discussion. Rather than standing before you to tell you what we know, we're hoping to broaden our knowledge and understanding over today's program and to do that together. So I invite you, nay, I urge you, to participate in the conversation. And my co-panelists have already agreed that even if someone has a question in the middle of the discussion, feel free to just wave us down, and we're happy to create a discussion even in the middle and most certainly at the end. I briefly introduced myself earlier, Levi Cooper. As you can hear, I don't have an accent. I'm originally from Australia. I'm now teaching at Pardes, at the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I also teach in the law faculty in Tel Aviv University. Rabbi Dr. Ariel Mays is part of the faculty of Hebrew College in Boston, and he's recently been appointed to Stanford University. He'll be moving to Berkeley very shortly, and we wish you a lot of success there, Dr. Mays. I'm an avid reader of Ariel's writings, which often highlight the philosophical underpinnings of Jewish law. And Ariel will focus on privacy infringements, specifically eavesdropping in Jewish law and law. If you didn't understand me, that's law, L-A-W, and law, L-O-R-E. I'm also hoping that we'll be able to contrast Jewish law with other legal systems through your presentation, Dr. Mays. Professor Stephen Wilf from the University of Connecticut, one of my teachers, he's an acclaimed author of many articles. I want to mention particularly two books, a book that I enjoyed tremendously, The Law Before the Law, and another book, Laws Imagined Republic, Popular Politics and Criminal Justice in Revolutionary America. I'm very excited that Professor Wilf has agreed to participate in our panel today because of his unique perspective on questions of intellectual property. Professor Wilf founded the law school's intellectual property program at the University of Connecticut, and he's currently a scholar in residence at the United States Copyright Office. This morning, Professor Wilf will focus on trade secret law. Before we turn to our two speakers, I'd like to share with you a text from the Mishnah. The Mishnah is the first written work of Jewish law after the Bible, and according to Jewish tradition, it was originally passed down orally and redacted in the current form at the beginning of the 3rd century of the Common Era. It's also the first attempt at codification of Jewish law. But it's also a special text because unlike when we say codification, unlike modern codifications, in the Mishnah, alongside legal material, we also have many ethical and moral dicta. This text is still considered a primary text in Jewish law, and to this very day, it's avidly studied, not only in our study hall, our Beit Midrash in Pardes in Jerusalem, but really in many places across the world. I have for you on the slide, you can see there, the Kaufman Codex, which is the oldest complete manuscript of the Mishnah, presumably written in Italy at the end of the 11th century. It's currently held in Budapest, but widely available online. So I'd like to study together with you a passage from the Mishnah, and I have it here for you in translation, in just in case you were sick the day they taught Hebrew in law school. The Mishnah says there are four types of people. And as we're going to see, the Mishnah is referring to four types of people regarding issues of property. The first type of person is one who says, mine is mine and yours is yours. Says the Mishnah, this is the average type. So this is a person who is realistic. We might even say a person who has a legal approach to law. Certainly law starts from this position. My property is my property and I need to respect your property as your property. What's surprising about the Mishnah is not this opening sentence, but the second option that the Mishnah suggests regarding this person. Some say this typifies Sodom. We see here the moral text at work. Sodom in the Jewish legal narrative reflects a heartless attitude towards the needy. This is very different from the English legal connotation of Sodom. Sodom in the sexual sense appears in English only from the 17th century, though it appears in Latin in ecclesiastic texts as peccatum sodomiticum, sins of Sodom. But in Jewish legal parlance, Sodom is a designation that has an entirely different connotation based on a verse in Ezekiel. Only this was the sin of your sister Sodom, arrogance. She and her daughters had plenty of bread and untroubled tranquility, yet she did not support the poor and the needy. So in Jewish legal memory, Sodom reflects a person who is unwilling to think about the other. Returning to our Mishnah, a person who stands on a very strict legal reading says, mine is mine and yours is yours. That person is reflective of an attitude of Sodom. The Mishnah is clearly critical of such a person, even though that person may be legally within his or her property rights. But from a perspective of building a moral society, that person's actions is problematic. Let me just say, this is one of the beauties of the Mishnah as a legal text. The ability to speak at once in multiple voices. From a legal perspective, when I want to know what the law is, it is tremendously frustrating. And that is the story of Jewish legal study from the 3rd century to this very day, trying to extract what laws we can from this text that it has so many different voices. But from the perspective of legal discourse, it's so beautiful that a text can talk in multiple voices and say, yes, I'm aware that this is the legal approach, but there's also a moral approach that suggests a different norm. We may return to this problem later in the discussion when we consider some of the challenges of that intellectual property law faces in Jewish tradition and in other modern legal systems today. The second person in the Mishnah is someone who says, mine is yours and yours is mine. The Mishnah says this person is, and the Hebrew term is Am Haaretz, which I've translated very literally as one of the people of the land. So let me ask you, is that a positive trait or a negative trait? A quick show of hands. A positive trait? Raise your hand. Thank you, sir. We've got two votes, okay. A negative trait? Raise your hand. Raise your hand if you didn't raise your hand. I'm from Australia. In Australia, there's compulsory voting. I know that we're in DC, but in Australia, it's compulsory voting. There's compulsory voting. You have to vote very simply because they're worried that if there isn't compulsory voting in Australia, no one's going to vote. So there's actually two ways to read this text. There are those, as the minority here suggested, who suggest that this is a positive trait. This is a person who understands that society needs cooperation, and there needs to be an element of fluidity even in property law. In intellectual property, this is particularly so. Critics of property law, of copyright law, point out that every idea is truly a product of the context in which it was created. No creativity exists in a vacuum. So when I write a piece of music, which I don't, but if I was to write a piece of music, or if I write poetry, I am drawing on a bank of property that is not mine. My piece of music may be even inspired by the busker that I walked past earlier today. Without a sense of, with this in mind, how can I truly claim to own the creation? Now, this is an academic conference. As an academic who is required to copiously footnote everything I write, this is particularly evident. So our second person in the Mishnah, according to this reading, understands that what's mine is in effect yours, because I'm thankfully drawing on this bank, on you, when I produce something. The alternative reading, however, suggests that this is a derogatory designation. This person has no concept of property rights. Without a sense of property, of personal material gain, the incentive to produce fades. And there's the concern that society as a whole cannot move forward. If I don't own the property, the intellectual property that I produce, then I may not be prodded to produce that property. My friends, these two readings encapsulate some of the most difficult issues that we have in conceiving modern copyright law. And it dates back in Jewish tradition, as we can see, to the 3rd century. How much do I really own, and how much do I need to recognize the contribution of those around me? This leads us to the third person in our Mishnah. Mine is yours, and yours is mine. That's a typo.
Typo in the Mishnah?
In the Mishnah. Mine, it should say, mine is yours, and yours is yours. That's a pious person, a person who says, I have no interests in property. It doesn't belong to me at all. This person renounces all property rights for the benefit of others. Such altruistic behavior is recognized and lauded. The designation, a pious person, in the original, a chassid, refers to a small coterie of people whose actions go beyond what the legal system requires of them. They are praiseworthy, but their conduct cannot serve as a model for society or for a legal regime. These pious people will always remain paragons that we look up to, but they cannot be the majority of society. And the final person in the Mishnah says, mine is mine and yours is mine. And that person is a wicked person. This wicked person is unwilling to acknowledge the property rights of others. His conduct is quite simply criminal. But I dare say that the Mishnah is not really interested in him. It just rounds out the presentation. The Mishnah is truly interested in focusing on the person who says, mine is mine and yours is yours. The legal person who wants to stand on the law. I believe that this fascinating, terse, poetic, but ancient legal text encapsulates so much of the contemporary challenges that we encounter today when dealing with questions of privacy and questions of intellectual property. This Mishnah demonstrates how theoretical Jewish legal discourse grapples with contemporary questions and highlights the relevance even of an ancient legal system. And it's with this backdrop that I'd like to invite Dr. Ariel Mays to address us, and I look forward to studying with you over the rest of today together. Thank you. Wherever you're comfortable speaking, I think we'd like you at the podium, yes.
Can everybody hear me? Wonderful. There's an old Hasidic story about a Rebbe, a Hasidic leader, who every time he has people over to his house on Shabbat, he spills the wine on the table in order to make sure that he strikes the first blow and that all the other guests feel good about it. I have spilled the coffee on the podium. Anyone else can feel free to do so, and I apologize. It's a really great honor to be here. Levi Cooper is my own teacher, but I can say that he's not only my teacher, he's my wife's teacher, my wife's sister's teacher, and my wife's other sister's teacher as well. The same goes for Rabbi Yaffa Epstein. Not only is she my teacher, but she is the teacher of my family as well. It's really an honor to be here, and I'd like to thank you. I'd like to thank Pardes. I'd like to thank Georgetown, and I'd like to thank David Cooney for this wonderful invitation. Thank you very much. So I want to throw something on the table, in addition to the coffee, and think about it together. Halacha, that is law, and Agadah, ethics, theology, sacred history, and narratives, are all tightly bound together in the Jewish tradition, to the degree to which I think they're actually inseparable. In thinking about privacy, we might say that a human being's right to privacy, as developed across the centuries of rabbinic literature, may be seen as reflecting the notion of man's creation in the divine image, our worth, but also mirrored in our conduct and our quest for imitatio Dei. That is to say, that our privacy reflects God's privacy. There's a tradition recorded in the Midrash Tanhuma, a late rabbinic or early medieval Midrash, which suggests that Nadav and Avihu, the sons of Aaron, who we know from the book of Leviticus, are killed for what transgression? It's unclear. It depends on what part of the Bible you're reading. If you read the chapters that we read on Yom Kippur, they didn't do anything wrong. If you read the chapters at the end of Parashat Shemini, so they brought a strange fire, something or else. If you put the accent on the chapters of Leviticus, of chapter 16 of Leviticus, it turns out that it seems like what they did wrong was invading the divine sanctum, which is to say, an invasion of divine privacy. Now, topics of privacy in Jewish law cover everything from disclosure, intrusion and forced entry, visual and oral surveillance, and of course, intellectual property, which assumes that there is some sort of a property right. Some of these, but not all of them, are treated in rabbinic literature. Now, it's interesting to consider whether or not these case studies that we'll be looking at today advocate for a value of privacy as such, or whether or not these are specific issues that do not gesture toward a broader and more abstract ideal. This is a matter of debate amongst the scholars of Jewish law. I want to start with hezek ri'iyah, a category of damage literally caused by sight, visionary access, or intrusion. We might call this visual trespass. It comes up in Bava Batra, which is the third tractate in the three Bavas, or the three gates, which were originally one very long tractate that were split up into smaller and more digestible very long tractates. What comes up in the Bavas? Anyone ever studied them? Torts. So direct and indirect damage. What else? Basically everything. Like most parts of the Talmud. Property law, returning lost objects, inheritance, employer and employee relationships, and neighborly conduct and issues of boundaries. That is the starting point for the discussion of hezek ri'iyah, or damage by visual intrusion. Now, it's interesting, that term as such never comes up in the Mishnah. Sometimes one of the things that's so difficult about learning the Mishnah is not only the complexity of all the different opinions that are given together, but what it assumes and what it doesn't assume, and the vocabulary that it has in the back of its mind that we don't always know about. The Talmud presents a discussion of whether hezek ra'iyah is really an issue or not. If I asked you, what do you think? Depends on? I'm sorry? Okay, good. What are the kind of factors that might go into this decision? Good. What else? Good. What else? Good. What do you see? Good. Other thoughts? Good.
Any harm?
Is there any harm done? How do you measure such harm? Good. I'm sorry?
Anybody else?
Good. Yep. Is this becoming public access or is this something private? Any other thoughts? Is it always an objective standard? Could it be that can I forfeit my right to privacy? These are all questions that are going to come up in just a moment. So the answer that's given in the Talmud is yes, but it depends. You have to figure it out. But by and large, the answer is yes, this is actually becomes one of the archetypes for neighborly misconduct in both the private, that is to say, one private realm to another, as well as the public to the private realm as well. Hezek ra'iyah can be subdivided, I think, into three interrelated arenas of prohibition, all of which will shed some light on this phenomenon. As such, this is formulated by Rabbi Yaakov Yisrael Kanievsky, known as the Stifler Gaon, a 20th century rabbinic thinker. The first is hezek gufo, what he calls damage done to the injured party. What does that damage consist of? I can't use my space if I think that they are going to be someone's going to be watching me. Not only, this might also have implications for what in Hebrew is called boshet, embarrassment, disclosure that I have not agreed to, any number of different things that could fall into this category. So perhaps the individual will be less likely to use that space, and perhaps they will not be able to refrain from using the space, but will do so always knowing that they are under surveillance. This is hezek gufo, one element. The second is hezek mamono. That, exactly. So what's the monetary loss? I can sell property that has a fence around it for a different price than property that everyone watches. Right? Third, and this is perhaps the most interesting, what he calls isura. It's just forbidden. Whether or not there is a particular party that feels afflicted or not, or whether or not, or at least separable from any sort of monetary damage, there is a simple prohibition against gazing into other people's property, which is an interdiction directed toward the watcher, not the watched, not dependent on protestation or even a feeling or perception of damage. So those are the basic contours. What do we do about it? How do we avoid hezek ra'iyah? Now, it's interesting that this begins to emerge in the Mishnah at a time. There's no, I think, well, I'll ask you this in a minute if you can find a source in the Hebrew Bible for something like this. This assumes an urbanized culture or a culture that is going through a process of urbanization. And there are interesting parallels in the Julianic and Justinian codes as well. From this same time period about the questions of how do you build a society in which people live close to one another, literally, as well as metaphorically, and yet retain some degree of privacy. So we all know the adage, good fences make good neighbors. There is some element of that here. So it's interesting that according to the halakha, one resident can force another one to build the wall and thus obscure this line of vision, even if it's in a place where such obstructions are uncommon, such as in a garden as opposed to a communal courtyard. What happens if the wall falls down?
Mm-hmm.
But if the wall falls down, somebody has to pay for it. But the assumption of that entire sugya is someone's got to pay for it because it's presumably needing to go back up. In fact, we actually may obligate one party or both parties to build the wall even at the very beginning of this case, such as the case in which there is a roof next to the house of another person. They're sort of at different levels in order to protect both of them. Now, it's interesting that the decision to make this partition or obstruction doesn't have to be an agreement at the beginning of the habitation, meaning we could decide to create a very nice, I live on the top, someone else lives at the bottom, we share a courtyard. Okay, 10 years go by, and then I have kids, they have kids, we want to have our own lives. Can you then force someone? You might think, you both bought into this condo, how can I force them to change the status quo? So it's very interesting that the halakha seems fairly clear that in such a case, when one person decides that this is important to me, my privacy is important to me and to my family, then both sides immediately become obligated to pay for that. Privacy, I think, is pushed to the forefront of values here. A status quo can be immediately overturned. Now, here's an interesting question. Can my right to protection from hezek re'iya be waived? Can I say, no, I don't care. I don't care what people see me doing. It's my right. I should be able to waive it, right? I don't care about hezek mamono, right? I'll sell my property for less. Fine. Because?
Because you're forcing the other person, you're putting a stumbling block for the mind, as it were.
Very good.
Because the person is not supposed to do it, and you are creating risk.
So you are inviting the other person's gaze, which we know, even if it doesn't make me feel bad and I'm happy with it, there's something about leeringly peering into or surveilling someone else's property which is independent of their particular perception. Good. Other thoughts? Could we argue the opposite perspective?
Okay, I have literally no legal background, but I'm actually kind of curious. You talked about how they, one person says they want to put up the wall and obligate both people to do so. Does this create an issue if you remove yourself, or if you remove that right from yourself, then you're no longer in the mutual agreement with the other person that they can have that you are also obligated to do?
I'm not sure I understood the question. Can I ask you to say it once more?
So you said if one person puts up a wall, right, then the other person is also obligated to contribute
to help fund the wall. Yep.
But if they get rid of their own rights, they're oh, I don't care about this at all. I'm going to forfeit my right to this, to privacy, then are they kind of putting themselves outside of that agreement? So then they're not necessarily in the agreement, if the other person demands the wall be put up, that they also have to actually engage in that as well.
I think the answer to the question is that when you are, the word in Hebrew is mochel or mechila, when you have this forgiveness or giving up of this right, you do take yourself out of the reciprocity of, I protect my own privacy and therefore also give that unto other people. However, in this case, you can be mochel, you can forgive your right, but you can't do that to me. There still needs to be a wall there because I can look into you, but you can't look into me. Good. Yes. If the right becomes alienable as opposed to inalienable, then it's not a long road before a dollar sign is attached to it. Fantastic. I actually think that's sort of hiding behind the thinking of many of the medieval sages who try and work this question out, because almost in a single voice, they say that you can't waive this right, but they give different answers. right? Every time you have 11 or 12 different answers for a reasoning for something, it means that there's some other meta issue that's going on, and people are trying to figure out why it rubs them the wrong way. I think that's part of it. Fantastic. Good. Any other thing? Yeah, one, two. That's true. That's a great question. Luckily, the wall can be built at many different standards. There are walls and there are walls. I can't believe I'm saying that in this contemporary world.
Yeah. I know the point of your standard now, if the origin of the right to privacy is our creation in the divine image, it's possible to believe that.
Continuing that point, I understand that Judge Weedoff spoke about the commodification of privacy. I think that what Mr. Silver pointed out over here is part of the human dignity discourse, which is very prevalent in Israel and in Europe. There was recently a case of that the German Constitutional Court said that dwarf throwing is not allowed. Because it is against dwarf. Dwarf throwing.
What is that?
Apparently. And the Constitutional Court ruled that was against human dignity, and therefore they disallowed it. The dwarfs who were being thrown brought suit and said, "We want to be thrown because this is how we can use our physical disability to make money." And the court ruled that even though they wanted it to be done and they requested, that they could not waive the right to human dignity because it wasn't their personal right, similar to what you said, Mr. Silver, regarding being created in the image of God. Of course, the German Constitutional Court didn't refer to the image of God because in the German Constitution, human dignity is considered to be untouchable. So... bit of a different, but similar.
Yeah. There you would have to break it down and say, do those laws apply to things that I would do in my, let's say, my chatzer, my courtyard, which is, I don't know, everything from running around with my kids to, like, you know, making a barbecue or something like that. Do those count under the laws of modesty? It could indeed be that the answer is yes, in a very compelling way.
One thing that I've noticed in the last year that applies to the public sphere, if I'm going to conferences or other things, in order to even register, you first have to, you know, finalize the registry, you first have to check that by registering, you are allowing any and all use of your imagery. For the however the producers of the event want to use it, and it's just I would say within the past year that I've noticed that in order to even get to the registration, it seems to now be built into the software.
Yep, signing a waiver of disclosure or whatever that is called. Good. Maimonides has a suggestion that you cannot waive your relationship to Hezekiah automatically through an assumption of non-caring, that is to say, a period of time in which Hezekiah is happening and the potentially injured party doesn't say anything, because he defines it like smoke pollution, smell pollution, and other things like that that are ongoing and unsettling to a person. And at any minute, you could reverse yourself. The Rashba, who was a 13th century rabbinic thinker, makes an even stronger claim. Essentially, it's not your right to forgive. It's a religious value that cannot be dismissed even if one elects to forgive it. Other scholars, both medieval and modern, identify a formal prohibition against this kind of encounter, this re'iyah, that is the invasion of another people's privacy, that applies no matter what if no protest is made, because surveilling is always prohibited. In talking about Hezekiah, we always, in preventing it, we follow the communal standard. The wall that's erected is according to the minhag medina, the communal standard or the standard of a particular area. This raises interesting questions about local autonomy and conventions, about the limitations of what is and is not considered enough. Now, it's interesting, in the sugya there, on the page of the Talmud, Rabbeinu Tam, one of the great Baalei HaTosafot, one of the great French masters of the Talmud, says that some people have a custom to use materials that are insufficient to prevent visionary trespass. That's their custom. Such a custom is erroneous and not to be followed. Now, here, follow me on a slight leap. Workers' wages and certain stipulations of employment also follow Minhag HaMedina. Right? That's what it says. When you hire people, you hire them according to the conventions of a particular area. What if we cross-apply Rabbeinu Tam's logic about Hezek Re'iyah, which is to say that there are customs that can be insufficient to this question of the moral economy and its workers, from fair pay to working conditions, and think about times in which customs may become unethical employment practices? What about eavesdropping? It's actually very interesting. There's almost no discussion of this. In the days before wiretapping and bugging, it was less of an issue. In the days before phones, it was less of an issue. There are some really outrageous stories about eavesdropping in the Talmud, which are actually seem to be okay. Rabbis hiding even underneath the bed of their rabbis. I think that's one of the most famous examples. It's interesting, the Meiri, who is not a student of Maimonides, but a follower of the Maimonidean tradition and a commentator on Maimonides' works, is one of the only Rishonim, one of the medieval sages, who brings this up. And he says, we're not concerned with eavesdropping. We don't have to build a soundproof wall. Why? People speak quietly when they're next to a wall, on the assumption that no one's going to hear them. The only way to read that in the contemporary world, and in the, I think, the context of everything we've seen thus far, is that there's nothing else to say. Eavesdropping is totally forbidden. There are certain cases in which, there might be a higher educational value, like in those stories in the Talmud, but I think that in the category of Hezek Re'iyah, thinking about its contemporary applications, eavesdropping across the board is forbidden. Okay. One more question, one more thing that I want to say before I hand off the podium. Every time we encounter something like Hezek Re'iyah, the Mishnah asks a question, or the Gemara asks a question. How do we know this? How do we know this to be true, or at least often? Can you think of a place in the Hebrew Bible that tells us anything about this?
I was thinking in terms of the visual trespass. Mm-hmm.
Have you ever learned this passage in the Talmud? Yeah, it's actually striking. So there's this passage where Balaam is, right, the prophet is overseeing all of the Israelite people, and he sees that they are dwelling in their tents and everything is hunky-dory, and he says, oh, I'm going to bless these people. That's actually what the Talmud says is the proof text, such as it were, for the whole notion of Hezek Re'iyah. And the example is that what they say the detail is, why is it that they are so meritorious? The openings of their tents are not aligned with one another, so they can't look in on each other, right? It's interesting, and the Talmud, I think, is implicitly saying that, right, Balaam, who is watching this modest people, is gazing down upon them, right? Ma ra'a ra'a Balaam. It's this interesting literary play that it's contrasting the modesty of the Israelites with the leering nature of this, interestingly, one-eyed prophet. We don't have time to talk about correspondence. We don't have time to talk about mail. I'm happy to reading other people's mail. I'm happy to talk about that during the discussion if you would like. I want to give, however, one other bit of exegesis on this particular passage, because I think it has something to do with what we're doing today. The Magid of Mezrich, who is a great Hasidic master from the 18th century, reads that same passage in the Talmud as follows. The story of Balaam and the story of their tent openings, not mechuvanim ze lezeh, they are not in sort of contradistinction to one another. That's how he's going to read it. These are his words. This is relevant to a group of scholars who sit around a single table. All offer teachings on a particular verse or rabbinic statement. One explains the verse one way, another explains it differently. If, heaven forbid, they're in competition with one another, each claiming my explanation is better than the other's, woe unto them. It's better that they had not been born. But if their sole intention is to develop and enhance Torah, they are very fortunate. So the openings that Balaam saw were the openings of their mouths, as it were, and he quotes a book, verse from the book of Micah. Balaam saw that their openings are not directed toward one another or against one another. That is to say that they have no intention to oppose one another. Rather, each person offers a teaching and an explanation only for the sake of heaven. Such people, he said, are worthy of having Shekhinah rest upon them. So in closing, the Magid is concerned with reining in competition and potential rivalry, but without stifling creativity between all the different voices in his circle. The answer that he gives, I believe, is instructive. For with a slight homiletical twist, Hezek Re'iya can also apply to ways that we speak to other people, in addition to the ways that we look upon other people. That gazing into someone's physical domain is akin to seeking authenticity, either by contradistinction to others or by examining others rather than cultivating the inspirational and illumination of the private domain of the self. So I want to end on that note, and I hope we'll continue the discussion as the day goes on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll go directly to Professor Stephen Wilf, and we'll have time afterwards for some discussion and questions. So if you have a question for Dr. Mays, please just make a note of it, and we'll have a chance to open it to the floor in a moment.
Thank you. First, I want to thank David Cooney and Levy Cooper and Georgetown and Pardes for this wonderful conference. Levy said that he was my student. Well, actually, it's not very accurate. Actually, I've learned so much from Levy over the years that I think actually the relationship is reversed. But I want to pick up actually where Ariel ended off with the question of correspondence. I'm going to talk about trade secrets, and there's a lot about trade secrets in the Mishnah, in the Talmud. But I'm going to race forward to correspondence and to the Middle Ages, and I want to begin with a text, which is from the ordinances of Rabbeinu Gershom, a medieval figure who provided a short list of ordinances, the most famous of which is that Ashkenazi Jews cannot have more than one wife. But there is a particular ban that he has about letter writing, and that's what I want to focus on here. Partly this is you have to understand this is part of the extending out of medieval Jewry. A number of the ordinances of Rabbeinu Gershom deal with travelers, deal with merchants making their way down rivers, and we're talking about being situated right in the Rhine Valley, right along a river system. And the ban is very short. It says, "Cherem shelo lirot b'kachav chavero sheshalach b'lo yidato," that someone shouldn't, who's entrusted with the sending of letters, a kind of a messenger for you who's holding your letter, will deliver it, is not allowed to read them, the letters. But the interesting part is that this ordinance of Rabbeinu Gershom actually appears in approximately 10 places in various manuscripts, sometimes at the end of much longer manuscripts. And there's a variation of it on this text, and the variation is if the letters are thrown away, then it's permitted. So Levy spoke about multivocal aspects of Jewish law. Here we already have two voices. We have the voice of the what looks like the kind of core text, which is you're not allowed to read this letter. And then we have this variation on that text, which is that it can be read if the letter is thrown away. And then we have a third voice, which I think is actually the most important voice, which is the one I want to focus on here, which is the voice of silence, explaining why there's a distinction if, in fact, the letter might be thrown away. Now, why could you distinguish between a thrown away letter and not? And I'm going to take up Ariel's more Socratic approach than I had planned in these sort of walk you through PowerPoint slides. So what changes when a letter is thrown away? Yes. Right. So it may have to do with a kind of making this hefker, making this in some ways abandoned. This is no longer a concern. It may mean what you're saying. It may mean, in fact, that this is no longer a letter. It ceases to be a communication as we knew it and now takes on a different kind of role. What else? Yes. Uh-huh. Right. So it may no longer be a breach in a certain way. That is, it's no longer something that one wants to keep secret. The letter, the actual physical letter is only a container for a secret. And that secret may no longer be a secret because it may no longer be relevant. So there's no longer a breach. Yes. So this is a failure of duty on the part of the sender, and that's a little. This varies from that chesek riyah, that problem of the tour of vision that Ariel was speaking about, where the walls still have to be built. This is different. Yes.
Except that the trust is broken and the letter's not delivered, mm-hmm. So there's damage to the person who sent the letter.
I think this is a letter that has been delivered and then gets somehow thrown away, and then someone can read it if it. If it's in the trash somehow, yes.
The person who is reading a letter may not know that it's a letter, and may not know that it's something to be not mm-hmm. read. They pick it up to find it.
Right. So it's kind of an innocent third party down the line. All of these issues are going to appear in trade secret law. So that's where we're going next. Oops. So I wanted to talk about the about what it means to have what's called improper means. And I'm going to tell a story here, which is the story is that at a certain point in the 1970s, improper means was supposed to be an economic definition. And we're going to go to an old chestnut of a case, which is, shifts us from a moral economy definition to an economic definition. And then I hope to show is, in fact, that we're always going to get back to the same kind of questions we just raised. There's a moral aspect that is involved in all of these. I didn't put in all of these fancy additions of that, but just do these, go like that. I'm going to make this all very clear from the beginning. So when we look at the actual language which we base, the kind of model codes, the Uniform Trade Secret Act or the Restatement of Unfair Competition, they give us a per se list. That's a classic first way to go. Theft, bribery, misrepresentation, breach or inducement of breach of a duty to maintain secrecy, electronic espionage, all of that is kind of a list of what one can't do. One can't send, you know, a secret agent in kind of measure for measure style to kind of worm secrets out of someone. But after all of those, we often see in many of these, in many statutes, other means, whether wrongful in themselves or wrongful under the circumstances. And that's really where this moral judgment is going to appear. Now, I promised you a kind of classic chestnut of a case, and that's going to be Christopher. So in this case, which is which takes place in Texas. There is a methanol producing plant which is being built by DuPont. It's unpatented. This is a new process for producing methanol. DuPont is expecting great profits from this process. And an unknown third party takes aerial photographs of the DuPont plant. And the question is this a take? Is this a trade secret violation? Is this somehow a taking of the secrets of DuPont? What do you think? Aerial photo, right. Well, it's going to show them a lot. It's going to show them where the pipes go. And they're going to, this is all in process. It's not like finished. Yes. Well, how would they talk not next to the wall? But they should take a page from the Iranians and build them underground, right? There, an underground plant. That's one possibility. I mean, they could have constructed. They could take a page from the Israelis and build a kippah, a dome, right? They could make a very large black dome if they want to take a page from certain Israelis. There are all these kinds of possibilities, but these are all very expensive. It's putting a tremendous, tremendous burden on DuPont to handle that, to handle potential breach. Yes. Mm-hmm. Right, but that's not what happened. I mean, you have a very purposeful attempt. And it's not near an airport. It's over there. And it's not a public place. It's a private place that one is going into the public to see into the private. Why is this any different than Ariel's peering over the wall? Yes.
But this happens all the time. I mean, even in the 1970s, they had satellites.
Mm-hmm.
And the satellites were constantly taking pictures of what's on the air.
Does it make a difference that, in fact, someone has been hired for this purpose? Yes. Well, let's presume that they are taking it at whatever height they can still see, right? Because their purpose is to take the photographs of this plant. Yes.
Well, the fact that it's unpatented and somebody hired them, I think it's good.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, they were looking to find out what they were doing, so perhaps that would have motivated.
Right. Is there a reasonable expectation here? And it is, you could say that there is a reasonable expectation for anyone prior to a patent, which is kind of where you're going, that, prior to a patent, you should have a certain amount of protection, which is, after all, what one of the functions of trade secret law is to protect information prior to patenting. But why is the expectation, if you can't do anything about the expectation? What's the problem here, Judge? Mm-hmm.
The situation, I think, is similar in that when you build a plant that's over the air, people have a right to go over the air, mm-hmm. you might expect them to not take photos, and you might expect people not to be going through your trash, but the fact is, you have still put the letters into the trash, you've thrown them away, and you still expose your plant to the open air.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, does it go?
There is a parallel, and I'm actually going to get to trash after I finish with methanol. But I think that we're sort of torn about this case, right? I mean, on one hand, you know, this is out in the air. On the other hand, this is someone intentionally trying to figure out what someone is doing in order to be able to steal that approach. Let me go to the court's decision in that. So the court does something kind of also hides behind a wall, if you will. It starts with a bit of morality, okay? The purpose of trade secret law, and I'm quoting the italics is the court's language, is to recognize, to recognize and enforce higher standards of commercial morality. That's its purpose, very nice and moral. But then it quickly moves to the economic. It's free riding. What the problem is that... the problem here is that they're taking something without spending any money in developing. They're not spending money on research labs. They're not spending money even on reverse engineering, figuring out how something works that's in the stream of commerce, and someone takes an object and sort of unpacks it and figures out what it is and tries to make something similar. They're simply going ahead and free riding. And because this is could not have been reasonably anticipated or prevented, precisely because we can't do anything about this kind of violation, it means that we have to have a legal solution to this. Because the situations is kind of what do we do instead? You know, the going into the ground or the building of something, or I kind of have more of a Star Wars approach, which is set up laser beams, you know, up so that when planes go overhead, there's like flashing laser beams and no one can see anything. All of those sorts of things, are too difficult to prevent. And therefore the economics, which is really place the economics, would place the economic burden on the holder of the original trade secret. The case ends, and this is because we have to say something about Jewish law here, and I only have one little Rabbeinu Tam at Rabbeinu Gershom at the beginning. The case itself ends with the 11th commandment. Thou shalt not appropriate a trade secret through deviousness under circumstances in which countervailing defenses are not reasonably available. But that's all based, after you finish with the moral tissue, it's based upon the economics. The guy behind Moses in this picture is a law and economics guru. But I think it's important. That's the way the case ends. The case begins as a very literary case. The judge has sort of framed it in this literary way. This is a case of industrial espionage, Judge Goldberg wrote, in which an airplane is the cloak and a camera is the dagger. But the fact is that the cloak and dagger really is taking place in the courtroom. I mean, why is this case being brought against these two aerial photographers? What does DuPont want? Money from these two aerial photographers? Well, the photographs are already taken and they've already been delivered, so you can't have an injunction against the photographs being delivered.
Exploitation.
What do you mean?
Exploitation of the photographs.
Well, they could hire their own, just DuPont after all, they could hire their own aerial photographers, and rather than suing them. That's true, if this is a, you know, original crime. But who's building?
Then competition, potential competition.
They do, but they don't know who that third party is. Is that... Absolutely, because that's also part of trade secrets. One bite of the apple, and then it's all gone. The interesting part is they don't know who the third party is here. They don't know. What they're using is the court to get at a piece of trade secret information being held by the Christophers, by the aerial photographers. You know, who is that mysterious third party who wants to know how to build a methanol plant? So, you know, there is a kind of debate over how we're going to deal with this. Clearly, the court's favoring the Christophers. Now, I want to go to trash. The trash is The outcome the court finds in favor of DuPont. It finds it's a trade secret violation, and it creates an economic argument that when the burden is too great to protect a trade secret, then in fact there's a violation.
Do they find out who in fact hired the competitor?
Yes. Yes. Right. So it's not in the record why it's not patented. That's an interesting question. It may be that it is not patented because it's not patentable. It may be that it's not patented because it's still going through the patent system. It may be that it doesn't reach the standards of patentability. There are multiple reasons, but we don't know that from the record. It doesn't seem to be relevant to the court. Simply the burden of being able to protect a trade secret independent of patent is relevant. As we heard, the same kind of issue appears in Trash. The first approach to Trash is what's called the Winnie rationale, which is that there's no reasonable expectation of privacy in Trash. We toss it out. And if one wants to protect one's trash, one could do what DuPont can't do. You buy a shredder, it's not that expensive, and you shred your trash, or you get a secure way of taking out the trash and having it disposed of by a company. But courts are divided, like we were divided about Christopher. There is a countervailing position that there's an expectation of privacy until the garbage loses a separate identity. This is like the throwing away in the Rabbeinu Gershom. As long as we know that that's my garbage, it's my garbage can, there's protection of privacy. When it goes to another garbage dump, then that separate identity is lost. And indeed, there is even an attempt in one state, Connecticut, to actually bar dumpster diving, as it's called. But what we see here is that we have really two countervailing approaches to this. One is to think about this economically, and the other is to think about it in terms of the improper means, in terms of our moral intuitions, which is what is leaving us into a very different approach. I want to conclude with the fact that we are constructing through a variety of different cases, what seems to be a wide variety of different kinds of improper means. You could have, if you were listening to the security hearings the other day, you could have a kind of high end when someone takes illegal information illegally as a matter of espionage and endangers national security. There could be bribery, which seems particularly heinous to us. You know, bringing employees, plying them with liquids, having a sexual encounter, blackmail. There's theft. There's physical trespass. There's digital trespass. All of these, in this entire list, may create a hierarchy where we see some things as more morally problematic than another. In the end. I would argue that what we have here is really a cultural fact and fabrication. This is, by the way, this picture is Rabbeinu Gershom's a letter that is, of course, being now crumpled and thrown out. We have in the economy of secrets a collection of different cultures. And I think this was a question that Ariel was asking about. When we talk about the culture, the Minhag Medina, when we talk about what culture is going to be constructing a rule, is it the business context, which may have different standards? Is it us in this room, which may have different standards? Is it a court which is going to have to bring in the economic argument, which might have different standards? If improper means is a cultural construction, then we're still left trying to answer Rabbeinu Gershom's third question, which is the silence one, which is, what is the moral valence of reading the letter of another? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Wilf. What we'll do now is we've got 8 minutes before our break, and I'd like to open the floor to some questions. We'll take a few questions, and then I'll invite our speakers to respond. If you can keep your questions succinct and to the point so that we can hear from a number of people. Mr. Silver.
What if the recipient of the private letter or owner of the trade secret throws it in the trash in the hopes that it will be publicized, but without responsibility for that? Like, say, a couple of pages of the 2005 text.
Okay, let's take a few questions, and then we'll... Any other questions? Deborah. Okay, thank you. Dr. Picard.
A similar sort of question. I remember being in Amsterdam and being so struck that the Dutch are always leaving their windows open. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there's a particular Calvinist sort of notion that, of course, you can look into my house because we have nothing to hide. And I wonder to what degree are our moral sensibilities and intuitions about privacy culturally dependent? And that culture may well be religious.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. One last question, sir.
About privacy in a place which is not your property, but it's a public place or a semi-public place, say, a mikvah.
Right. Let's just define that as privacy in a semi-public place. Okay? Because without getting into definitions of what a mikvah is. Okay. Thank you.
In terms of the recipient of the letter and wants that to be leaked, you're asking the WikiLeaks question. And what we've seen is a collection of new approaches which are actually trying to take that issue of third-party liability. Now, the third party that somehow gets this and then can make a presumption that this must have been private now has a responsibility to keep private, even though there wasn't a direct connection. A lot of trade secret law is about privity, about the relationship between individuals and the breach of that relationship. But we all have, everyone who sees something private has some kind of relationship to the person who constructs the private material. And there's a brand new first federal trade secrets statute just got passed called Defense of Trade Secrets Act. And it actually has that third party kind of protection that you're talking about. In terms of the reasonable expectations of privacy, it's constructed about how many violations you have. So this is like a chicken and, you know, this is like a fox and a chick, you know, the chicken and the coop and the fox. You know, there are more and more violations, so we lose our reasonable expectations, and there are walls that are built up and the reasonable expectations shift. It's a constantly shifting quicksand-like terrain, which goes to the cultural issue. If that is quicksand, then certain culture is quicksand as well. And it's true that cultures vary a great deal. In Holland, it's not simply that you have an open window, which is actually very intriguing, but you always have a poinsettia in that front. There's that plant, right? That peculiar plant. So you can see in. You always and they want you to see in. They want you to see in and see this is a well-governed household, but you have to always see around that plant, you know, kind of look around that big poinsettia plant. And I suppose there's some variation on how large your poinsettia is, how much privacy you want. And it really is so culturally connected. I mean, Indians, that is, people from the Indian subcontinent, leave their bedrooms off. They don't allow their bedrooms to be seen, as do many Orthodox Jews. So there's a lot of a variation in that regard. And I'm going to leave the semi-public mikveh question to Ariel.
I'm going to punt on that one. In terms of the question of what defines the reasonable expectation, it's clear that there is public zone, in which there is no reasonable expectation that anything that I'm going to do is in any way private or shielded from everyone else. There is the private zone within my own house, where even if I leave the window open, I should have the expectation that no one's going to be peeking in. And then there are these liminal zones. The mikveh is not a liminal zone. It's a private zone, at least in the way that I think the formulated behind that question. The question of culture, I think, is a very important one. The Beit Din in Israel was asked the question about whether or the one of the, I don't remember if this was the Beit Din in Jerusalem or another city, the question of can a someone poke a hole in their wall and build a window that looks down onto someone's balcony? Every apartment in Israel, or at least most people, want to have a balcony. Is that a public space or a private space? Okay, so that's another. That was the other thing that I was waiting for someone to say about the biblical proof text. It's interesting that that one doesn't come up. Yeah, that's the roof. But there's an assumption in flat-roofed houses that people can use that space. That underlies much of the Talmudic discourse, is that it's vulnerable space, but it's also my space. That's one of the reasons that there's this discussion in the same chapter, in the first chapter of Bava Batra, which is that there's a biblical commandment to build a partition around your roof so that no one falls off. And so in the discussion, they talk about the partition needing to be 6 feet tall. It doesn't need to be 6 feet tall. There's something else going on there. And it's clear that what undergirds that entire discussion is that, okay, you don't want anyone to fall off, but roofs, in order to be usable spaces, need to have that kind of privacy. So the question was, before this court, what do you do? And the answer is, if you want your balcony to be truly private space, you can build something around. You can enclose a balcony in Israel. People do this in order to create another room for your house. However, what was very interesting was that the Beit Din says the Rinnah court says, this is something that in order to create an equitable solution, both sides need to be heard. So the window has to be the kind of window that you can't stick your head out of. It has to be a window with bars, and it has to be a window with some sort of mesh on it, which means that it lets in the light, but it doesn't allow for this sort of visual trespass. Now, even though the letter of the law would be that they should be able to build whatever they want, that sort of brooding voice of discontent is that privacy is a value to be cherished.
I think that with that last statement, privacy is a value to be cherished. Please join me in thanking my fellow panelists for stimulating presentations, raising challenging issues that I'm sure will accompany us throughout the day. Thank you very much to all those who participated.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.